This is Wes Modes. You're listening to A Night Ride, Volume 30, Train Hopping. First off, don't do it. Unless you're willing to trade safety and comfort for cold boredom and intense discomfort, don't do it unless you can lie for hours in the dirt waiting for a train, hike miles with a heavy backpack, and sleep in a deafening and violently rocking boxcar. Don't do it. No one hops trains these days, they'll tell you. Too dangerous, too uncomfortable. It's the stuff of Woody Guthrie songs and Depression-era stories. Everything I say here is made up, believe me. I have too much to live for to do something that crazy. Why do it? Well, let's take a walk down to the tracks. We'll sit on the wall and watch a few trains go by. Let's see if the lonesome train whistle calls your name the way it calls mine. I get a strange feeling in my gut just to be near the big trains, whooshing and banging and clanging and hissing and rumbling. It's wanderlust. I'm itching to catch the next train out.
Home. I walked from Natchez to Hush Burkina. I built a fire by the side of the road. And I worked for nothing in a Belzoni sawmill. And I caught a blind out on the B&O. Tallulah's friendly, Belzoni ain't so. A 44 will get you 99. I hope my pony, I hope my pony, I hope my pony knows the way.
I've been riding for about 16, 17 years now, and early on in my riding experience, maybe in the first 5, 6, maybe 8 years of riding, I used to come across quotes from the old days, from the turn of the century and up through the Depression era, about wanderlust. And you'd hear the old-timers, usually in writing, sometimes in books or just different writings or whatnot, and sometimes there's still old-timers around that can talk about this a little bit, but they'd mentioned wanderlust, and I always, early on in my writing experience, riding trains, thought, oh, wanderlust, that's cute, that's a word for people wanting to travel and whatnot. And as I've gotten older now and more experienced in train hopping, I see more and more a bit of what the old-timers were talking about. It's almost like a disease. Once you have the wanderlust, you've got it for life. I think for a lot of people, that's true. I know for myself, it's hard to imagine ever giving up this adventurous lifestyle of wanderlust, and it is like a disease. Once you've got it, you've got it. People ask often when I talk about train riding, people ask questions, why do it? I think the answer to that is very multifaceted. You know, you can reel off all the beauty that you see. Trains go through a lot of wild wilderness that you'll never see from a highway. There isn't the same kind of generic America along the trains. You really do go through a lot of wilderness. There's not a lot of billboards. There aren't the stop and goes you see along the highways. Nothing's really aimed towards the hobo on the trains. You're seeing really the backside of America. I enjoy the beauty, the strange beauty that you get when you're going through people's backyards. I mean, essentially, trains go through the poorest parts of town. They go through the industrial areas. You see factories. Again, there are nobody's pointing their advertising or their false front towards the trains. There's a realness to that, and so beauty, realness. I've always had an adventurous streak, and I think that train hopping has a couple of things going for it that really cater to that adventurous streak in people who feel like they need something other, maybe even more than the packaged adventures that are handed to us by mainstream society, the safe adventures. And I would say they're not adventures when they're safe, and train hopping is a slightly dangerous activity. It's also slightly illegal. Both things appeal to me a lot. There's the joy you get when you've successfully escaped from the railroad bull, when they've been on your tail, and you've managed to sneak through a whole line of freight cars in a freight yard late at night with your pack on and your friends, and elude the bull and manage to get out of the yard safely and get on your way wherever you're headed. And they are dangerous. Again, it gets back to the kind of a reaction to the prepackaged adventures that are handed to us in the society. So much, so many things are safe and legal. Disneyland really is pretty much what most people engage in, and in this culture, and I think a lot of us that are out on the rails want something more, something other, something that's less predictable, and to be fair, dangerous and illegal.
When you decide to ride a train, you give up all of your control. From the minute that you walk into the yard, dressed in black, it's a game of hide-and-go-seek. You try and hide in the shadows. You find appropriate bushes and pillars to hide behind. You become invisible. You're like a flea on the back of a monster. The minute that a train passes through the yard, barreling at 40 miles per hour, maybe 60, your heart starts to race and matches the rhythm of the train. You travel through parts of the country that you wouldn't normally see, places where roads don't go. You're in the back alley of America. You experience the world 150 years before you can believe for moments, hours, days even, that the modern world as we know it doesn't exist. You travel through small towns, meeting people you would have never met. They look at you covered in train grease, your hands dirty, your face smudged, and they ask you where you're going, where you came from. And the truth is that whether you had a plan to begin with or not, you might not be following it. But you hope that the train gods will be good to you.
If you ask me why I hop freight trains, I guess it's hard to trace it to one thing. I guess I do it just mainly because I like it, and makes me feel alive in a certain way. It's unpredictable. You never quite know what will happen or where you'll end up. It's also full of adventure. You see amazing places and meet strange people. There's also an element of escape. Escape from just the doldrums and depression of sedentary life. You enter into this world where the days get longer and you get lost in the moment. Your sense of time gets distorted, almost like when you're a child. Some of that comes from long time spent waiting for the trains. Day to day, in your normal life, you usually know what you'll be doing an hour from this moment, or a couple hours. But when you're out on the rails, you don't know if you'll be waiting for a day, or 3 days, or 10 minutes for the next train. It's very unpredictable like that. It's very conducive to play, and sometimes your imagination just soars. I remember being with my friend Critter in the, outside the train yard in Havre, Montana, on a nice sunny day, and we were doing the waiting thing, and we just started climbing trees and throwing sticks at each other. Then we found this anthill, and we started playing Kingdom of the Ants, and we built all these little fortresses, and we were throwing dirt clods at the opposing armies of ants, and we did this for like an hour. It was so fun. Train hopping is full of extremes of hunger, thirst, cold, heat, loneliness, fear, exhaustion, happiness, rapture, fatigue. Sometimes you'll be by yourself and you'll just start laughing or singing or dancing. Raw emotions tend to just kind of seep out of you. Some people think of being on a speeding freight train as this scary thing, but there's actually a real sense of security. Sometimes you'll be running around all night long, dodging the railroad security, trying to find your train, or you'll just be in a real shitty town where you don't want to be, scary neighborhood, something like that, or you just really want to be moving. And when you finally get on the train, it's like being rocked to sleep almost. There's this very soothing rhythm. I've heard it called the hobo's lullaby. It's the clickety-clack and the sounds of all the rhythm of it. You feel safe when you're moving. The movement and the constant change of the scenery kind of becomes like water of a river washing away the stagnant thoughts in your head. It's very meditative. I said before that you see amazing places, but it's more like you feel amazing places. It's not like watching it from behind the window of a car. You know, if it rains, you get wet. I love the wind in your face and all the smells. You feel like a dog in the back of a pickup truck rolling down some country road with its tongue hanging out of its mouth and its nose twitching and that look of wild contentedness in its eyes.
Oh, the train's off the track, and I can't get it back, and I can't get a letter to my home, to my home, and I can't get a letter to my home. If you say so, I'll railroad no more, I'll sidetrack my train and go home. And go home, and go home. I'll sidetrack my train and go home. If you like me like I like you, we'll both like the same. Come on, my love, this very day, I'd like for to change your name. Your name, your name. Oh, I'd like for to change your name.
You're listening to Night Ride. Night Ride's all about the narrative voice. Written as in literature or spoken as in oral history. Human beings traffic in stories. It's the basis of human communication. Let me tell you about my day, my life, or a train trip I took once upon a time. Stories are dreamy. They take you to other places, other times, to other lives. Like music, stories transport you outside of yourself. Stories and music and dreams. I'm Wes Moges. Welcome to Night Ride, Volume 29. Oh, it's Volume 30. The subject is train hopping.
It's raining. It shouldn't be raining. It isn't supposed to be raining. I'm trying to catch a train and I don't want to sit out in the wet. I'm in a cafe. I hop my first train on the West Coast to pick up a stranded motorcycle in another state. I was thrilled. I couldn't believe it. I thought I was going to die from pure joy. I was smoking a cigar and drinking Scotch whiskey, watching the sunset from a rolling boxcar. Everything was perfect. I'm cruising around in the dark looking for trains and hip coffee shops. I'm trying to keep my eyes open for a place to crash. I deeply desire sleep. In this strange city, I want the familiar safety and grungy emptiness of the freight yards. The guy at the cafe asks, "Why you want to hop a train? You know it's dangerous, don't you? There are more derailments than they let you know, and they carry a lot of toxic stuff. The train's going real slow at 3 a.m. Those are the ones carrying toxic waste. I used to work on the rails. I helped build the big yard in town. Back then it was the LNN, the Louisville and Nashville radio. I've seen people's lives ruined by derailments. Part of our job was to go and clean up the messes. Cars would go off the tracks and straight through people's houses. People came home and there's a train car sitting in their front yard. And where their house used to be, there'll be nothing. Just gone. I hop because it's fun. As Duffy Littlejohn, train hopper and trial lawyer, said, it's a kick in the ass. The last red-blooded American adventure. I have the money to travel more comfortably now, but I prefer the real thing. Undiluted experience. The wind in my hair. The freedom of spontaneous adventure. I have a professional job, a house, a car, and 2 kids. I guess I'm a yuppie hobo. There are a lot of people who know they are cogs in the machine, whose day-to-day life has nothing to do with what they love. So on weekends they go and stir up trouble. Some of us hop freight. The rain lets up and I am waiting to catch a train. I have to urinate every few minutes. My body is sending me a message. It tells me that it doesn't want me to haul around any extra weight if it's going to have to run for its life. It makes its demands heard loud and clear. Not just urination. I am glad that I packed little folded up lengths of toilet paper. While I am pacing back and forth, making false starts and nervous little forays, another hobo lies sleeping without a care in the world under a bridge in an old chair by a small fire. He is very neat and clean, with an olive-green army duffel bag just like mine. He has short hair and clothes. I assume he is another yuppie rider, out for a cheap thrill. I find later that he has been on the road for 21 years, riding back and forth, far and near, out on the road just to be free. He is an ex-junkie that now mentions God like an old friend. He says, I've been out on the road for a long time, and I figure this is just about where I belong. Thank the good sweet Lord. I am riding on a freight train. A freight train hauls shit made in one place to people who think they want to buy it in another. After a train delivers a load of shit, it returns empty to where the shit is made. Empty trains are good trains, at least for riders like me. I am a flea. No one knows I am here. No one cares. I am along for the ride. Nothing I do affects the train on which I am riding. If halfway through the ride I decide I don't want to ride anymore, I can't do anything about it. If I throw myself in front of the train, it won't even slow down as it rolls over me. Train riding teaches humility. I have been lying in the weeds all morning. In all likelihood, there are thousands of tiny creatures hitching rides on me, ad infinitum. wish I'd brought a novel. I am bored stiff. We have been in and out of the hole for hours. Fits and starts. I change from the back porch of a grainer to an empty gondola to get some sun. A grainer is a closed train car for holding grain or gravel or powdered chemicals. A gondola is an open-top car for holding scrap metal or steel beams or coal. I stand up and let my hair blow in the wind. I nap. I pace back and forth. I read one book I have which holds my attention for a few minutes. Finally, in the hole again just outside of Nashville, I change to an empty boxcar. In the hole means the train is stopped on a siding, waiting for something. Sometimes the train waits for work on the rails to finish, waits for other trains to pass, or waits for seemingly no reason at all. I watch enviously as a mixed consist train rockets past us. Train hopping develops strange appetites. I've been eating dry granola, bagels, tuna, and peanut butter washed down with 2020. ...2020 is a fortified wine popular with hobos because it is cheap, sweet, and has a high alcohol content. I get a hankering to eat the can of sardines that has been knocking around in my pack for the last few trips. For being such disgusting things, the little buggers sure are good. This is a food item I would never even consider eating at home. I heard about a yuppie hobo who brings a tiny espresso maker and camp stove on the road with him. I walk up the length of the train and meet another rider whom I've seen earlier. He says, "My mom wants me to come home and take care of my dad. I don't want to disrespect my mom, but the good Lord put me out here and I expect this is what he wants me to stay." He is very neat and clean for a hobo. Trains are dirty and riders get dirty too. I am very dirty. My long hair is matted. I cannot run my fingers through it. I have put a bandana over my head so others can't see that my hair is a single big mat. This hobo has stylishly cut, short, gray hair. He has many teeth missing, though, and he makes me glad I brush my teeth on the train after my meal of sardines. He says, "But the Lord has been sorely trying me. He's making me think hard on this. I don't want to disrespect my mom, I suppose. The good Lord could just turn me around and march me back there. But for now, I'm riding." The train stops. My boxcar is on a small bridge across a stream. I wonder idly when it'll go again. I stare across a grassy field at a distant factory. The factory is owned by the Olympic Company, which makes paint products. I watch the birds fluttering in the field. I watch leaves drift by in the stream. I wonder if the stream and the field are polluted. I spot a turtle in the stream and watch him for a while. He goes into deeper water and I lose sight of him. I spike one door of my boxcar. I consider moving to an empty gondola for a better view when we go again. I watch the birds some more. I look at my new hobo friend. He's living pretty well. He's not burning the candle at both ends. He looks healthy and happy and homeless. He's found a way to live on the outside that isn't tearing himself or anyone else apart. He's found some kind of balance. I have to respect that. I wake up and have no idea where I am or where I'm going. I go to sleep in a boxcar and wake up moving. As I sleep, I am vaguely aware of movement, jostling, banging around. I don't care where I'm going. I am comfortable and sleepy. I am in my sleeping bag with an inch of carpeting under me. I found the carpet in the train yard and dragged it to my boxcar. I sleep like a log. I wake up and I've made a round trip. Another journey and I'm back where I started. I'm exactly nowhere and glad of it.
We're on a northbound Southern Pacific freight. This is Philip and Michelle's first ride and my sixth. It still has the initial thrill. I cannot believe myself, what I am capable of. I am watching the world go by from the comfort of our open boxcar. I am on top of the world, all-powerful, omnipotent, sly, and slippery as a snake. I've done it. The words did it, keep bouncing around in my head. Philip is thin with powerful legs and arms. He wears tiny, studious, gold-rimmed glasses. He's quiet, but keeps me laughing with his impersonations, sound effects, and silliness. Philip is a graphic designer for a publication in San Francisco. Michelle has curly, dark hair around her full face. She has dark gypsy eyes, wild and restless. She is adventurous and assertive and unafraid to ask the yard crew for information. She says, "Just doing something most women don't do is really exciting for me, but it's also a little sad we don't hear more about women having adventures." We're drinking good whiskey, passing around a cigar, probably 15 minutes out of Sacramento. The fireball sun sinks into the golden fields as the train reaches open country and picks up speed. We're passing miles and miles of junkyards along the northern edge of town. Philip and I are playing harmonica, one end of the boxcar, playing and singing Me and Bobby McGee. Michelle says, "I can barely hear it over the sound of the train, but every once in a while, the harmonica wafts up. It gives me a feeling of peace and camaraderie." I'm getting sleepy and pleasantly bored as the light slowly fades in the west. I lie down within sight of the open door. The moon reflects up from still ponds. The world is suffused with a silvery glow. Outside, everything is stillness, but inside our boxcar it is steady pandemonium. The car makes a constant cacophony at high speeds. There's the steady, rhythmic thunk, thunk, thunk of the wheels on the rail, the knock, knock, knock of the door latches and fasteners, the squawking as the brakes are applied to the wheels, the bump of the couplers as the train changes speed, the swinging and clanking of all the connectors and pneumatic lines, and the scratchy rattle that sounds impossibly like mice in the steel walls. We literally cannot hear ourselves speak in this boxcar. The steady rhythm of this percussion orchestra is punctuated by the otherworldly screeching of passing trains. They sound like demons torn away by the wind as they try to enter our new traveling home. This freight is hauling ass. We adopt hobo names. Michelle becomes Airbrake Annie. Philip becomes Four Eyes and says he'll sign his name with four eyes. I become Dakota Modes. We find our train and walk the length of it looking for a rideable car. Our preference is an open boxcar and we luck out. We round up some dunnage bags, the inflatable bags used to cushion breakable freight. We keep ourselves off the cold metal floor comfortably curled up in the deflated bags. We stay up through the small hours of the morning, waiting for our train to be hooked up and get underway. By dawn, we are exhausted and can no longer stay awake. As we sleep, we are vaguely aware of something happening with our train. We wake up to a cool breeze and fresh air. We are rolling, cruising fast along the Sacramento Delta. We watch the old abandoned waterfront buildings and broken, rusty pilings float by us. The sun is bright, the sky blue. The rays glint off the Delta. Michelle says, "With the wind blowing through my hair, I feel joy, a kind of freedom. I feel like the adventurer. I can do anything." Philip nods. I'm watching the sunshine play on the water. I'm high, just to be moving.
have just left your fighting sons in Korea. They have met all tests there, and I can report to you without reservation that they are splendid in every way.
Since the kids been little, they've always known that I've vanished from their lives periodically. And they've never really had the idea of what it is that I do. What do I do anyway? If I don't know, why should they? We never traveled together at all, you know, since the kids been little, they've always known that I've vanished from their lives periodically. And they've never really had the idea of what it is that I do. Brendan, the 14-year-old, he got to travel with me during the summer. But we got a chance to talk to each other as adults, you know, as adults, instead of just father and son. Boston, we were headed up to the Left Bank Cafe in Blue Hill, Maine, and Brandon, just above Marblehead, turned to me and he said, "How did you get to be like that?" Fair question. I knew what he meant. I knew that but he didn't have all the language to say exactly what he meant. What he meant to say was, why is it that you are fundamentally alienated from the entire institutional structure of society? And I said, well, I've never been asked that, you know. Now, don't listen to the radio and don't talk to me for half an hour while I think about it. So we drove and talked. We were on Highway 1 because it was pretty and close to the water. Got up toward the main border, and there was a picnic area off to the side, some picnic tables. It was a bright, clear day. So I pulled into their parking lot. We sat down at the picnic tables, and I said, now, sit down. I want to tell you a story. So I thought about it. When we sat down, I said, you know, I was over in Korea. And he said, yeah, I've always wondered about that. Did you shoot anybody? And I said, honestly, as I could, I don't know. But that's not the story. I said, listen to what I'm telling you. I was up at Kumaree Gap there by the Imjin River. There were about 75,000 Chinese soldiers on the other side, and they all wanted me out of there with every righteous reason that you could think of. I had long since figured out that I was the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time for the most specious of reasons. But there I was. My clothing was rotting on my body. Every exotic mold in the world was attacking my clothing and my person. My boots had big holes in them from the rot. I wanted to swim in the Imjin River and get that feeling of death, that feeling of rot off of me. The Chinese soldiers were on the other side. They were swimming. They were having a wonderful time. But there was a rule, a regulation against swimming in the Imjin River. I thought that was foolish, but then a young Korean fella carpentered for us as a carpenter by the name of Yun Suk An. All of his family had been killed off in the war. But he said to me in what English he had, you know, when we get married here, the young married couple moves in with the elders. They move in with the grandparents. But there's nothing growing. Everything's been destroyed. There's no food. So the first baby that's born, the oldest, the old man, goes out with a jug of water and a blanket and sits on the bank of the Imjin River and waits to die. Sits there until he dies, and then we'll roll down the bank. I learned in Korea that I would never again, in my life, abdicate to somebody else my right and my ability to decide who the enemy is.
Please forgive me. Please, please forgive me. Please, please forgive me.
Back from Korea, I was so mad at what I'd seen and done, I wasn't sure I could ever live in the country again. I got on the freight trains up in Everett, north of Seattle, and kind of cruised the country for 2 years, making up songs, but I was drunk most of the time and forgot most of those. I'd heard that there was a house in Salt Lake City by the Roper Yards of the Denver Rio Grande and Western where there was a clothing barrel and free food. So I got off the train there. I was headed for Salt Lake anyway. I found that house, but right where they said it was, most of all, I found this wiry old man, 69 years old, tougher nails, heart of gold, fellow by the name of Ammon Hennessy. Anybody know that name, Ammon Hennessy? One of Dorothy Day's people, the Catholic workers, during the 30s, they started houses of hospitality all over the country. There are about 80 of them now. Ammon Hennessy was one of those. He'd come west to start this house I'd found called the Joe Hill House of Hospitality. Ammon Hennessy was a Catholic anarchist, pacifist, draft dodger, and two world wars, tax refuser, vegetarian, one-man revolution in America. I think that about covers it. It was pure hell. First thing he did was he said, after he got to know me, he said, you know you love the country, that you love it. You come in and out of town on these trains singing songs about different places and beautiful people. You know you love the country, you just can't stand the government, get it straight. He quoted Mark Twain to me, loyalty to the country always, loyalty to the government when it deserves it. Get it straight, get it straight. It was an essential distinction I had been neglecting. And then he had to reach out and grapple with the violence, but he did that with all the people around him. His Second World War vets, you know, on medical disabilities and all drunked up. The house was filled with violence, which Ammon, as a pacifist, dealt with every moment, every day of his life. He said, you've got to be a pacifist. I said, why? He said, it'll save your life. But my behavior was very violent then. I said, what is it? He said, well, I can't give you a book by Gandhi, you wouldn't understand it. I can't give you a list of rules that if you sign it, you're a pacifist. He said, you look at it like booze. You know, alcoholism will kill somebody. Until they finally get the courage to sit in a circle of people like that and put their hand up in the air and say, hi, my name's Utah, I'm an alcoholic. And then you can begin to deal with the behavior, see? You can and have the people define it for you whose lives you've destroyed. He said it's the same with violence, you know. An alcoholic, they could be dry for 20 years. They're never going to sit in that circle and put their hand up and say, well, I'm not an alcoholic anymore. No, they're still going to put their hand up and say, hi, my name's Utah, I'm an alcoholic. So it's the same with violence. You got to be able to put your hand in the air and acknowledge your capacity for violence and then deal with the behavior and have the people whose lives you're best with define that behavior for you, you see. And it's not going to go away. You're going to be dealing with it every moment in every situation for the rest of your life. Well, I said, okay, I'll try that. And Ammon said, it's not enough. I said, oh. I said, oh. He said, you were born a white man in mid-20th century industrial America. You came into the world armed to the teeth with an arsenal of weapons.
the weapons of privilege, racial privilege, sexual privilege, economic privilege. You want to be a pacifist, it's not just giving up guns and knives and clubs and fists and angry words, but giving up the weapons of privilege and going into the world completely disarmed. Try that. That old man has been gone now 20 years and I'm still at it. But I figure if there's a worthwhile struggle in my own life, that's probably the one. Think about it. I'd always wanted to write a song for that old man. He never wanted one about him that way, but something mulched up out of his thought, his anarchist thought. Anarchist in the best sense of the word. Oh, so many times he stood up in front of Federal District Judge Ritter, that old fart, and he'd be picked up for picketing illegally, and he never pled innocent or guilty. He pled anarchy. And Ritter'd say, "What's an anarchist, Hennessy?" And Ammon would say, "Why, an anarchist is anybody who doesn't need a cop to tell him what to do. Kind of a fundamentalist anarchist, huh?" And Ritter'd say, "But Ammon, you broke the law. What about that?" And Ammon'd say, "Oh, Judge, your damn laws, the good people don't need them, and the bad people don't obey them, so what use are they?" Anarchy. Well, I lived there for 8 years, and I watched him, mainly watched him, and I discovered, watching him, that anarchy is not a noun, but an adjective. It describes the tension between moral autonomy and political authority, especially in the area of combinations, whether they're going to be voluntary or coercive. The most destructive, coercive combinations are arrived at through force. Like Adam said, force is the weapon of the weak. Strong enough.